Well, now I'm running late, running up here. Okay. Bass player's rubbing off on me. Have you ever misplaced something? Like something, you know, even maybe not critically important, but fairly important, your car keys or your wallet or something like that. Women rarely ever lose their purses. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, but that's a rarity. But like your wallet, your car keys, anybody ever go through something like that? Running around, you got to try to find them and stuff. How do you feel in that moment when you can't find that thing that you so desperately need? Frustrated. Anything else? Panicky. I heard angry. You get upset with yourself. What in the world? Where did I put those things? For some of us, that's like an hourly thing. You know, it's walking around trying to remember where everything is. When you find it, if you find it, but when you find it, we'll be positive. When you find it later on, you find those keys all of a sudden, what do you feel immediately as soon as you find it? Relief, don't you? It's just like, oh, okay, everything's back to normal. I got everything the way I want it. Relieved that what was lost, what we thought was lost, what we thought was a terrible disruption and interruption to our lives is actually now found. We're going to look at a story today about losing sight of Jesus. We're going to continue our study in the Gospel of Luke today. So if you've got a Bible with you, if you'll turn to Luke chapter 2, please. We're going to finish up that chapter today. It's a long chapter. I don't know if you've noticed that. We're going to read a story today that could be titled Jesus Lost and Found, but it's a story about Jesus in his youth, and it's actually the only story that we have in the gospel accounts, in the canonized gospel accounts of Jesus' childhood, of his formative years. And it has some very interesting lessons in it. Lessons that we're going to learn about Jesus, about the nature of who he is, but also lessons that we can learn about ourselves in the process as well. So far, we've been reading what has been called Luke's prelude. It's the story of John the Baptist's parents and John the Baptist's birth. It's the story of Mary and Joseph and the birth of Jesus and his infancy. And that's where we were last time. Jesus was an infant in the temple, and there were two prophetic confirmations of his life or who he is. And if you're there in Luke chapter 2, we're going to pick up in verse 41 this morning, and we're going to do this a little differently. A lot of times what I'll do is I'll read a little section, we'll talk about it, and we'll read a little more. But today I want to keep this story all together, so I want to read the whole section at once, and then we'll unpack what we can from it. Afterwards, I'll give you a heads up what we're going to do. I've got three theological truths that I want to look at concerning who Jesus is, about the nature of Jesus. And then there are going to be three practical observations that we can draw through parallel from this story. And they're short little points, so don't sit here starting going, wait, 6 points. Oh, I'll never get out of here. They're short, so we'll get moving along here. So it's starting here with verse 41. It says, now his parents, talking about Jesus, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents didn't know it, but supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey. But when they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances, and when they didn't find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress. And he said to them, why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house? And they didn't understand the saying that he spoke to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom, in stature, and in favor with God and man. And that's where we'll stop today. Luke provides us the context for this story by mentioning when this story takes place. It's during the feast of the Passover, and he also mentions Jesus' age. Now, the feast of the Passover was probably the most important of the Jewish holidays, then and now, because it marked the beginning of Israel as a nation. It was a celebration remembering how God brought the Israelites out of Egypt when they were slaves in Egypt, thousands of years before that. And it included, it was a 6-day long festival that would take place in Jerusalem, and it included different ceremonies that would take place publicly in the temple there. It would be the time when each family would choose their Passover lamb. They would bring it before the priests, the slew of priests who were there who would inspect the lamb, make sure it was suitable for sacrifice. There would be public feasts and different types of meetings that people could gather with, all leading up to the actual Passover that took place on the 15th of Nisan in the Hebrew calendar. And after that actual ceremony then, the actual Passover feast itself, meal itself, it would all go into Sabbath, the Sabbath time, and then it would roll right into one more celebration, one more holiday called the Feast of First Fruits, where the Jewish people acknowledged that God was the one who provided all their crops and provided everything that they needed to sustain them. So basically what you had there was a 7-day holiday, which that's what I'm talking about. I mean, this whole thing where we get one little day of holiday, that is ridiculous. To me, that's just stupid. But we're just in such a hurry in our culture that we got no time for anything else. I mean, if we were to take a full week off for a holiday, that would spell disaster for most people. But I'm convinced we're the ones missing out, but that's another thing for another time. Anyway, that's what this family's doing in this story. They're making this pilgrimage to Nazareth, I mean, to Jerusalem from Nazareth. It's about a 3-day trip to get there. And they would have gone in a big caravan of other pilgrims who were going to Jerusalem, all the different people that were in that community of Nazareth and the surrounding communities. They would have all gone together for community's sake and also for safety's sake. They would make the trip through the outback areas there to get down to Jerusalem. Now, this was a significant time for Jesus because it says that he's at 12 years of age. And at age 12, his religious instructions would have intensified and become more serious at that point, according to the commands of the Mishnah. The Talmud and the Mishnah are the oral law. They're not the same as the Torah, which is the written Old Testament like we have, but they were the laws that were developed by the rabbis. They're actually what Jesus will later on refer to as the traditions of men. But according to those requirements, his religious instruction would have intensified at the age of 12. So that was significant, especially in light of this story here. This was not the bar mitzvah celebration that we're familiar with in our day and age. The actual bar mitzvah of a 13-year-old boy in the Jewish community didn't happen till about close to a couple hundred years after this thing. It wasn't even in practice at that time. So this is our stage. We've got this important Passover feast. We've got Jesus at this transitional time in his life as it touches his religious heritage. And it's in this setting that Luke tells this story about Jesus being lost and found again. So as the family's heading home from Jerusalem, they make this startling discovery that Jesus is not with them. He's not in their company. And we'll look at that in a little bit here, but they immediately, as any parent would do in a panic, rush back to Jerusalem to try to find him. And they look all over the city trying to discover where he is, and they finally find him there in the temple. And Mary, as we read in this, sort of rebukes Jesus, goes up to him basically like any parent would do, saying, "Son, what were you thinking? We were going nuts running around the whole city trying to find you. What were you thinking there?" But interestingly enough, we get a view about Jesus' own developing self-awareness because he actually doesn't accept this rebuke. I don't know if you noticed that in the text here, but he doesn't accept that. Instead, he sort of pushes back, and how he pushes back, what it is that he says here, speaks volumes about who he is. He says to her, "Why were you looking for me?" In other words, why were you searching all over the place? Why were you looking in different areas throughout this city where you thought I would be? Why didn't you know this is where I'd be? You should have known this is where I would be. So we have this clear declaration from Jesus' side of his own awareness of mission. Jesus is clearly on a mission here. And that's our first theological observation. Jesus is on a mission. Now, the story is breaking new ground here because this is the first time that we've actually heard Jesus speak in Luke's gospel. Joseph and Mary, we're going to need to appreciate that Jesus is on a unique mission just as much as we, the readers, have to begin to appreciate Jesus' unique mission, because that's the very thing that the disciples will struggle with all throughout the narrative, that they make this assumption about who Messiah will be and what it is that Messiah will do. And Jesus has a very clear sense of mission, and it's very unique. It's much different from what everybody else anticipated it, just like it was much different for Joseph and Mary to find their son where they found him. Jesus is in the temple, and it says he's sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking questions. I'm sure you've seen those popular images, those paintings, Renaissance paintings and different kinds of paintings where you see the child Jesus in the temple there and all the religious leaders are around him sitting in rapt awe as he's instructing and talking to them. If you haven't seen those, well, look for them. You'll see them. They're all over the place. And that's usually the way that this image is represented. But actually, it wasn't like that at all. In fact, the text doesn't describe that in the least. It says he was listening and he was asking questions, not instructing. And it says that the people who were observing this were impressed. But what they were impressed with is this young man who's able to hold his own in a discussion with elders, with his elders, with those who were adults. We don't get the impression here that Jesus was taking over the class in some way. It was a regular practice for teachers and priests to be there in the temple to help instruct young men and children in terms of the issues of the law. So this was just a class, basically, that was going on that Jesus happened to kind of sit in on. And he was skillfully interacting during what was called the Midrash. A Midrash is where the scholars would get together and they would begin to discuss, and just as the sound of the name implies, they'd kind of hash it all out. They'd talk about what the Torah means and how it's applied to our lives. So this is what Jesus was doing, and this is what Jesus points to when he tells his parents, "Didn't you know that I must be in the house of my Father?" That's a little tricky in the Greek, because in the Greek it actually says, "Didn't you know that I must be about my Father's?" No, nothing. Zip. "I must be about my Father's." And that's it. And we're supposed to devise what it is that they mean by this. Scholars are divided on this. Some will look at it and say, okay, he's in the temple, so it must be saying I'm in my Father's house. I must be about my Father's house. Others will say, well, no, he was involved in the practice of teaching, so he must be talking about his Father's business. Honestly, the idiom in the Greek could support both concepts. The idea of being in the house of your Father is also about being carrying on his business or his purposes. And his purposes would be, in this context, to be teaching. So I think it's fair to be able to infer from this that Jesus' mission was to reveal through teaching the ways of God. I believe that's what was being represented in this. Teaching was going to be a large part of Jesus' ministry. There's two things that we'll see amaze people over and over again. It's his miracles and it's his teaching. It's those two things. And what Luke is telling us is that Jesus has come to teach us, to show us the ways of God. That's why he's engaged in this process, so that our spirituality won't just be a mere religion, or just a vague groping around in the dark. He came to tell us what God wants. That's Jesus' purpose. He came to disclose for us God's plan for mankind, what he wants for life for us, and how it is that we're going to get home. He came to teach us about God's kingdom, which he planted on this earth when he planted it in our hearts. The other thing that Jesus revealed in his answer is this sense of awareness about his relationship to God. Luke's gospel, we'll see, kind of reveals Jesus' identity slowly, you know, brings the reader along piece by piece in drawing us to a conclusion or an understanding of who Jesus is. And this is our first clue that Jesus himself gives to us in this answer, because Mary said, "Your father and I have been searching for you." And Jesus makes this point to immediately distinguish between Joseph and his father. I don't know if you caught that in his answer there, where she says, "Your father," he comes back and says, wait, you got to understand who my father is. Clearly showing an awareness on his own part of the uniqueness and divine way in which he came into this world. And he calls the temple his father's either house or his affairs. Either way, he's making an unmistakable allusion to his relationship to the divine. And so we can draw another point from this, a theological point concerning Jesus, and that is, Jesus is the Son of God. He doesn't say our fathers or Israel's fathers, but he says my fathers. He makes it very personal. I was watching one of those shows on National Geographic about the Jesus of history. And one person who was being interviewed said with great certainty, which is the stuff that really kills me, how everybody, you know, and it's not just people on National Geographic. Theologians and all kinds of people will do this, speak with such great certainty about things that, you know, there's no possible way to be absolutely certain about. But anyway, you know, he says with great certainty, Jesus never claimed to be God in the Gospels. That was a later invention by Paul and other later followers of his. And look, while Jesus never came out and said, by the way, dudes, I'm God, or something like that, there is no mistaking the inference of the statement there in verse 49, especially in light of what we know about Caesar Augustus, who himself claimed to be the Son of God. I don't really think it's fair for a person to say, well, look, I don't believe Jesus was God, but I think he was a good man and a wise teacher, because Jesus' own words here in verse 49 make him neither wise nor good if he's not more than just a man, if he's not divine. If he's not divine, based on his words here, then he's a megalomaniac and a fraud. Somebody on par with Caesar Augustus or David Koresh or somebody along those lines. And I understand, I realize we can make a statement like this, and I understand that as we're investigating this, you know, this is not going to persuade anyone who doesn't already believe it. Just saying that Jesus is God isn't going to convince somebody to be able to swallow that intellectually. I can understand that. I mean, we can't prove to anyone's intellectual satisfaction that Jesus is God, but we can look at our lives. We can look at what's transpired there, what's happened in our lives as we've believed on him. We look at how the truth of his teaching molds us into different people, into people who can make a difference in this world, who can help alleviate the suffering of those around us, who can bring hope to the hopeless. Those are the things that transpire in our lives based on his teachings and our acceptance of him as more than just a man. There's something to this Jesus. For those of us who believe, it's far more intuitive than intellectual. There's an ineffable rightness to the idea that Jesus is the Son of God, that Jesus is divine. And we've certainly seen the effects of that in our own lives. But the other thing we notice about Jesus is that verse 51 says that he went home and he was submissive to his parents. So while we say with this kind of clarity that Jesus is declaring himself to be God, we believe that Jesus is divine, we also say that Jesus is fully human. Another theological point here. Jesus is God, and Jesus is totally a human being, a man. Yeah, I don't get that, Rob. Yeah, neither do I. That's just one of those things. That's what the scriptures seem to reveal. Jesus identified with us all the way, fully human, so that while his origins are described as miraculous, his experience was exactly like ours. His experience was identical to what it is that we experience in this life. He had to obey his parents. He had to honor them. He had to abide by their rules when he was a teenager. Think about this. We're talking about God. God had to take out the trash and do his homework and stuff like that. And not God disguised as a human being, but fully human. This is that strange and powerful teaching of the gospel, which actually sets it apart as quite unique from other world religions. God loves humanity so much that instead of wiping it out or demanding that we somehow transform ourselves or ascend in some way or appease him in some other way, God cares about us so much that he actually took on our likeness. Though he made us in his likeness, he became one of us to bear the consequences of our sin for us, to experience what we experience and then provide a way home through the midst of all of this, through the suffering of the cross. God provides a way home. But that's getting ahead of our story. At this point, we see that Jesus is on a mission to reveal and teach God's way, that Jesus revealed that he's a being of divine nature, but he is yet still fully human. He's God, and yet he's human. And those are actually very technical, theological points. They're good to learn. They're good for us to know and understand about the one that we follow. And yet there's still something else in this story that I'd like to look at. And that is Joe and Mary's part of the story. Because you know, we kind of passed over it real quickly there, but you kind of wonder about this a little bit, don't you? I mean, that you've been traveling for a whole day, and all of a sudden they realize Jesus isn't with them. I mean, that seems a little bit amazing. But as we put ourselves in the position of Joe and Mary, as we think about where they are and what's going on here, it was a 3-day journey back to Nazareth. We know that. And all of the families would have been packing all of their stuff and getting their carts loaded and making all the preparations to do this trip. They would have all set out together in a caravan together. And so you can imagine what the scene would be like as it's going down. The women are all gathering around talking, you know, packing up the stuff that they need. And of course, they're just hashing over everything that went on during the celebration. You know, did you see what so-and-so wore to the feast? Can you believe she had the gall to wear something like that? And the men are, you know, sitting around waiting impatiently to get on the road, you know, looking at their watches, checking the fuel on the donkey and thinking about that shortcut that somebody had mentioned, wondering if they should try that. And if you've ever seen Home Alone, you know how easy it is still to make a miscount as you're trying to gather up all the family and get everything. It's like if you go anywhere with a large family, it's like herding cats to try to get anything to take place. And we know that Jesus had brothers and at least one sister. So it's very easy, at least for me, to imagine that they could somewhere along the line lose sight. I mean, if he's got brothers and a sister by this time, we know then that Jesus is not the only child, and so he's not the center of their universe. If you have multiple children, you realize how that changes. You know, baby books is a great example of that. Our first child, ooh, baby books, little stages all the way through. The last child, no baby book. We got no time for this stuff. Come on, get in the car. Let's go. They probably head out. They assume, you know, that Jesus is with them or with the kids or with the other family up there because he was always hanging out with them and doing stuff over there. Look, I'll make a confession. Robbie probably doesn't want me to make this confession, but I'll make it because she's hidden away in the media room. But one time, years and years ago, and it was winter, and I will stress this over and over, okay? It was winter time. Robbie's stepsister had come to visit us, and they had 5 kids, and of course we had 4 kids, and they had this huge 15-passenger van, and so our 4 kids jumped in with their 5 kids in that van, and you know, all these kids are there, and we're gonna take them down to show them the beach, and so we went down to the county pier, and so we got down there, and Robbie and I drove separately, and they pulled up in the van, and all the kids pile out in one big, you know, bundle of child, you know, excitement. And they're all down there, and they're playing around and throwing sand, and you know, we were down there on the beach, and it was wintertime. Did I say that? Okay, it was wintertime, and you know, and well, they're all playing around there. We're on the beach and stuff like that, and finally everybody's going, well, we're tired. Let's head on back. And as we're going back up to the van, I just happened to notice on one of the windows that there's this little half head poking up through the window, a little hair tousled up. And we were looking at the van, and we all kind of looked, the adults looked at each other, and we suddenly started looking around and making a head count, and sure enough, my younger son had never made it out of the car and was sitting there in the van the whole time. It was wintertime. Did I say that yet? So listen, the thing about it is these kind of things happen. You get around. I mean, nobody's perfect. Don't judge me, okay? This stuff happens. I mean, who here as a parent doesn't have things that they cringe about or look back and go, ooh, I can't believe, you know, that my kids survived that one. But, so for their, you know, in their situation, a whole day's journey goes by. Probably that night as each family is settling into their camp and, you know, getting settled down for the evening, they suddenly look around and say, wait, where's Jesus? I thought he was with you. No, I thought he was over there with the Millers. No, they're not even Jewish. They're not even doing this. And so they run around to the friends and the relatives' camps to look for him, and there's no Jesus. And so here's what I see as an interesting parallel here, because Joseph and Mary, they're faithful to keep the Passover celebration. They paid the cost that was necessary to make this trip to Jerusalem, and it says that they did this annually. You know, every year a devout person would make this pilgrimage every year to do this in keeping with the law's commands, but in the process of the journey, they got caught up in the busyness of the travel. That's the only explanation we can find for that. And in that, they lost sight of Jesus. So as we journey along in God, desiring to be faithful to God, we must not lose sight of Jesus in life's busyness. And an interesting parallel. There's no doubt about it. We as 21st century Americans, we are extremely busy people. I mean, don't you think we are? I feel like we are. there's so much to do. And I mean, there's so much to do all the time. Even like we were talking about before, we can't even imagine something more than just a one-day holiday. I couldn't stop for more than one day. I got too much stuff to do. I got too many things to get done. Check this out. In data collected from over 20,000 Christians in 139 different countries, though mostly out of the United States, between the ages of 15 and 88, a spiritual growth survey found that 4 in 10 Christians around the world say they often or always rush from task to task. How many here would fall into that category? How many here believe that they often or always are rushing from task to task? I would say that that's the majority of us as we're looking at this. 6 in 10 Christians say that it's often or always true that busyness of life gets in the way of developing my relationship with God. Christians most likely to agree were from, of course, North America and Europe and also Africa, interestingly enough. Busyness was more likely to affect men than women in every surveyed continent except here in the United States, where 62% of women and 61% of men reported that busyness was interfering with their relationship with God. By profession, pastors were most likely to say that they rush from task to task. 54% of them surveyed said they do. And 65% of those said that adversely affects their relationship with God. The professor who conducted this study at Charleston Southern University School of Business said it's tragic and ironic. The very people who could best help us escape the bondage of busyness are themselves in chains. Tragic indeed. And I'm certainly not going to stand here and say that I'm not part of those statistics. I will certainly place myself in the ranks of those who have to address this in their lives. And our desire to be faithful, which is something we did hear from the Lord about, God's encouragement for us to pursue faithfulness. Let's not confuse faithfulness with busyness, because the two are worlds apart. In fact, faithfulness could actually mean just the opposite of busyness. And the stuff that we do and the stuff that we attend to in our daily lives and in our church, let's be sure to stop and look around and ask this question that Joseph and Mary didn't ask till much later. Where's Jesus in this? As we go through our life and all the busyness that is entailed in that life, to stop and ask, where is Jesus? Now, practically speaking, I mean, how do we do that? I mean, you know, we can't be walking away from the job and the boss says, well, where are you going? Well, I'm looking for Jesus. I mean, we'll be looking for a job too. Obviously there are things that are going to have to be attended to in this life, but initially what we can do is get our focus straightened out. It's a matter of focus in this whole thing, of bringing the reality of Jesus into all aspects of our lives. I'm not just at work, I'm working where I've been placed in this world by Christ, and I'm open and I'm ready for His direction and His appointments. Now, that doesn't mean we're having a revival meeting over at our cubicle every day, but it means that we're in the world with Christ's presence in mind, ready and willing to do whatever opportunity comes before our before our eyes, ready to follow His lead on all things. I'm not just at school or at home with the kids. I'm where Christ has put me, ready to do what He calls me to do to make a difference in this world, to demonstrate the reality of the kingdom of God in this world, whatever that may be. And that may just be doing what I do at my work, but doing it as unto Christ, keeping Jesus in the focus there. That's how we keep Him in view during the busyness of the journey. But that doesn't mean that we just automatically say, okay, so we're Americans and we're just going to be busy and that's just that. No, I think that the other aspect of this is to begin looking at our lives that way. What are, as Americans, we are consumers. And as consumers, we are hoarders. Every one of us is probably guilty of this in this room. And that includes the tasks that we do. We hoard jobs. We hoard appointments. We hoard all these things. And just like it's an important thing for us to do as human beings to go through our houses every once in a while and de-junk the thing, get rid of some of this stuff that we don't need anymore, disperse it to people who maybe are in need, we also need to go through our schedules and start looking at that. Now, what really needs to be here? What really has to be here? Begin to clean out some of the junk in our schedules because we're prone to just being drones. We just are, guys. We've got to face that in our lives. As Americans, that's a unique temptation that faces us. We've got to look at that. Pay attention to that. Don't let busyness crowd our spiritual lives, our lives, so that we undermine the spiritual aspect of our lives. But we notice also that Joseph and Mary, they first went to their friends and their relatives. That would only be normal. But we could also make another sort of parallel here quickly, and that is that we don't find Jesus by association. They didn't go and find Jesus over there with their relatives or things like that. Sometimes people will recognize their need for more in this life. Sometimes they'll even pinpoint it down to saying, you know, I need Jesus. So they'll set out, instead of to necessarily find Jesus, they'll set out to hang out with people that they think know Jesus. They'll go settle into a church somewhere, but Jesus is not actually found by association. We have to seek him personally. We have to call out for him. Not just hang out with the people that he knows. We're not going to find Jesus in religion. We're not going to find him in religious behavior. We're only going to find him when we personally seek him, when we're looking for him specifically. So instead of passively hanging out at church and trying to change our vocabulary to include a few choice God things here and there, we need to quietly and privately cry out to him. Jesus, I need you. I know you're not lost, but I'm lost. Bring me home. Bring me to yourself. Let me find you. He hears those prayers. He answers those prayers. That's why those of us who are following him are following him. The last parallel that I see is that when they did find Jesus, they were really surprised by him. And Jesus will often take us by surprise. The fact that they were searching around indicates that they looked a lot of different places. They looked in the places that they would have assumed a 12-year-old would have been. They went to the arcade. They went to all the different places there in Jerusalem, where they would have assumed that a 12-year-old boy would be. And when they did find him, he wasn't where they thought he would be at all, and he wasn't doing what they thought he would be doing. And that's sort of going to be a theme throughout Luke, that Jesus is oftentimes the unexpected Messiah. In fact, this whole scene is almost a harbinger to the end of the story. At the end of the story, and I don't want to give things away, but surely you've heard some of these before. At the end of the story, there are two disciples walking to a town in Emmaus. And it's been about a 3-day difficulty for them. They're sick and they're sad because they thought they had lost Jesus, only to be surprised by finding that he was right there with them. Most of us prefer our gods to be predictable and controllable. That's why humanity usually prefers idolatry, because we can experience that illusion of control when we make our own gods. We can tell our gods what to do and how to do it. And as Christians, we're prone to that same danger. We can still fall into that. We can imagine a Jesus who's predictable, who's safe, who's locked inside of our religious boundaries. But Jesus, and make no mistake of this, Jesus is anything but safe. He is running wild through the earth and in strange and unexpected ways. And in our journey, we don't want to limit the possibilities of Christ by imagining him small enough to control. We don't want to miss him because we make assumptions about where we think he wouldn't be or what we think he wouldn't be doing. This can come down to a very practical level of how we treat other people. We can be quick to write people off because of how they appear, how they're kind of rough around the edges. We may look at them and say, oh, well, Jesus would never be there. I know better than that. But we have to be careful that we don't find ourselves trying to tame the king, trying to tell Jesus where he's going to be or what he's going to do. I love that story that Mike Iaconelli tells in Messy Spirituality. You've heard me mention it before about he was speaking at a conference one time, and he was talking about a woman in his church, a very godly woman, he said, who also happened to smoke like a chimney and have very salty language. And one of the pastors that was there in the conference got up and stormed out and accosted him later on, very offended with him, because that pastor did not have any room in his worldview for a smoking, cussing, godly woman. But the reality is that Jesus does. And we've got to be careful, because Jesus is full of surprises. And as it touches the people he deals with and the people that he loves, I think many of us are going to be very surprised when we come into the kingdom and we recognize who's there. I Okay, well, finishing up. What did we learn here? Well, we learned about Jesus, that he's on a mission to reveal God's way, that Jesus is the self-declared Son of God, and yet Jesus is also fully human. He was in submission to his parents, so he identifies with us, fully God, and yet identifying with us in our weakness and our frailty. We also learned by the example of Joseph and Mary that we have to be careful not to lose sight of Jesus in the busyness of our lives. As we're following him, as we're desiring to be faithful to him, not to lose sight of him in the midst of all of that. We also found that Jesus isn't found by association. And when we do find Jesus, when we are set to look in the places that we hadn't expected, be prepared to be surprised that he'll oftentimes surprise us. So let's go out into this world and let's be surprised by him. Right on? All right, very cool. If you guys will stand with me, please, we'll close up here with a song. God, we're so grateful to you for what you revealed to us in your word. And Lord, we just pray that we do learn from this example, that we do take these things to heart. Especially as it touches that area of busyness, Lord. Especially as it touches those things that can cause us to lose sight of what's really important. Help us, Father. We're in that place. We need your help. So we ask you to do that, Father. Open up our hearts and heal us and lead us into the kind of life and life management that you have intended for us. We pray that you do that, Lord, in Jesus' name. Listen, we're also going to have some people over here to pray for you. If you have any needs or anything, make your way over there while we're singing. We definitely want to pray with you and seek the Lord with you. Don't leave here not having reached out in some way if you're in need.
I have a maker. He formed my heart before even time began. My life was in his hand. He knows my name. He knows my every thought. He sees each tear that falls and hears me when I call. I have a Father. He calls me his own. He'll never leave me, no matter where I go. He knows my name. He knows my every thought. He sees each tear that falls and hears me when I call. You know my name. You know my every thought. You see each tear that falls, and you hear me when I call. And you hear me when I call. And you hear me when I call.
Well, let's speak this blessing on each other before we bail out. May the peace of the Lord Christ be with you wherever he may send you. May he guide you through the wilderness, protect you through the storm. May he bring you home rejoicing at the wonders he has shown you. May he bring you home rejoicing once again into these doors. Go in peace, you children of God.